That is Afro-Cuban jazz history. It's Manteca, the first tune based on the Afro-Cuban clave rhythmic beat to become a jazz standard, thanks to Chano Pozo, the legendary composer and percussionist, U.S. jazz great Dizzy Gillespie on trumpet, and Gil Fuller, writer and arranger for many big bands of the 1930s and 40s. This was recorded in 1955, 4 years before the Cuban Revolution. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. President Barack Obama today caps his historic 3-day visit to Cuba with a speech delineating his version of a working relationship with a communist state now that the United States has agreed to cease hostilities initiated in 1959. We are going to make sense of his visit today with our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, John Jay and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and a frequent analyst of world affairs right here on Lead Stories. He's here to discuss Obama's visit and its implications. Dr. Horn also teaches diplomatic history. He is the author of more than 30 books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, and more than 100 scholarly papers and papers that focus on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His most recent book, published earlier this month, is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. Thanks, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, what do you make of President Obama's visit so far? We talked about it yesterday in terms of how the media have been covering it. What sense do you make of it? What is the significance of his visit?
Well, it's disappointing that, by and large, the U.S. media has not focused on the underlying reason for President Obama's trip, which has everything to do with U.S. imperialism's larger global strategy, which includes the so-called pivot towards Asia, pivots towards China more specifically. As tensions between the United States and China ratchet up in the South China Sea, the United States does not want to be faced with an October 1962 scenario. Recall then that Moscow had placed missiles in Cuba that Washington found to be threatening, and it almost led the planet to the brink of nuclear destruction. As we speak, there is grave concern in Washington that Chinese encroachment in what is referred to colloquially as the United States' backyard is growing too rapidly and too swiftly, not least in Cuba, which in many ways has replaced the former Soviet Union as a patron of Havana, but I might also say in nearby Bahamas and Jamaica as well. This was the underlying reason for the overtures made to Havana, and once again, we see that the U.S. ruling elite has not been open and frank and candid with the U.S. populace, which leads the U.S. populace to come to ill-considered conclusions. What I mean is that the way this is being portrayed, by and large, is some sort of giveaway to Havana. It's difficult to see, as things are constructed in the U.S. media, what the U.S. populace is getting out of this deal. You can see that Carnival Cruise Lines and Airbnb and Starwood Hotels and other such major entities may be getting something out of this deal. It reminds me, quite frankly, of the move in the United States in the 1950s to move away from U.S. apartheid, Jim Crow. It was largely driven by global considerations, the fact that the United States found it difficult to pose as a paragon of human rights virtue in the ongoing battle with the Soviet Union over human rights as long as Jim Crow obtained, and so that created an external force that led to the retreat from Jim Crow. But that was hardly ever mentioned to the U.S. populace, which I'm speaking, of course, of the much discussed of late U.S. white working class and middle class now opting in huge numbers for Donald Trump. They were led to believe then that, once again, this was some sort of giveaway They could not understand why this was happening. And so it seems that the U.S. ruling elite is making the same blunder once again.
How much of the president's visit do you ascribe to the title of his book, Audacity and Hope?
Well, I must say that obviously in breaking with decades of U.S. policy towards Cuba, President Obama is barking on a new path. And certainly that new path is appreciated in Havana. Perhaps the Cuban government will have to spend less, one would hope, on military and security, and can spend more on its heralded programs in education and healthcare, which even President Obama saluted. But I think we should be clear that, as President Obama himself has hinted, he has broken with past policy because it didn't work. By saying it didn't work, what are you suggesting? That it did not accomplish its goal of overthrowing the Cuban Communist Party. And as he sees it, this new approach of flooding the island with capital and U.S. tourists, and as he made in his speech this morning to a Cuban audience, dropping broad hints as to why the Cuban populace should be disgruntled, that will accomplish the purpose more so than five decades of isolation. We shall see.
Well, the tone of media coverage also suggests that the Cubans are kind of, blindsided. They're going along with this because it's a good deal, and that they're not nearly as sophisticated as one would think in terms of really working this moment in time to their advantage. What indication do you have from the Castro regime that the president, in fact, is on equal terms with the Cubans with regard to this negotiated settlement?
Well, if anything, I think there might be unequal terms, because I think that the Cubans in many ways are in the catbird seat. As the exile community in South Florida has indicated more than once, it's difficult to glean what kinds of ideological concessions that Havana has made. And it's difficult to glean because I dare say that there probably are not any. They have not retreated from the socialist project at all. They have not agreed to Washington's demand that Assata Shakur be turned over forthwith. And so I think as well that the Cubans are in a better position to analyze the global currents that drove Washington to the bargaining table and impelled President Obama to come to Havana. That is to say, they know more than most that the United States strategy towards China is what's driving this deal, and that puts them in a better position to then take advantage of the deal that's being offered.
We still have some messy details to deal with, and that is the embargo actually has not yet been officially lifted, and the president is on his way out. What is the attitude going to be? How does the president really do a complete deal here, causing this embargo to be lifted in Congress? What is going to happen with that?
Well, I don't think you should expect, to put it mildly, that the embargo will be lifted in the waning months of the Obama administration. As we know, there is a Neanderthal lobby in the highest ranks of the Republican Party, which is determined to be obstructionist. You see this with regard to the U.S. Supreme Court. And by the way, going forward, it would not surprise me if the Republican Party control of the Senate means that in the next few years, if there were more vacancies on the U.S. Supreme Court, there would be no new appointees confirmed. I think that they're determined to see the court in their hands. And I think that in de facto sense, you can see the court going down to seven, maybe six members on an indeterminate basis. And so I don't really expect the blockade to be lifted as long as the Republicans dominate Congress, which they do. I don't see that ending anytime soon. Likewise, it's going to be very difficult to remove the other sticking point in terms of normalizing relations. I'm speaking of the U.S. encampment at Guantanamo, which Congress is adamantly opposed to turning back to Cuban sovereignty. Recall that the GOP presumptive nominee, Donald J. Trump, has talked about increasing the number of prisoners in Guantanamo, not decreasing the number. And I think that this really presents the U.S. left with a very stern challenge, which I'm not sure it'll be able to confront. That is to say that the Neanderthal lobby in the highest ranks of the Republican Party obviously have a very strong foothold in the white working class and white middle class. But that's something that's very difficult for many of our friends on the left to concede, as bent as they are on the idea of the 99% versus the 1%, not realizing that that may be objectively the case, but subjectively in North America, ever since the settler colony was commenced, there have been part of the 99%, particularly those defined as white, who've been willing to cut a deal with the 1%, even though those deals are oftentimes against the interests of the 99%. So that's what we're stuck with. That's what we're left with. Fortunately, the Asian conundrum has forced President Obama to move towards normalizing with Cuba. But I think that normalizing will basically be at the margins for some time to come. That is to say, in terms of an artful interpretation of the rigors of the blockade law. And you can expect, for example, more businesses descending from the United States on Cuba. Hopefully that'll help to create momentum that will make it difficult for a Donald J. Trump sworn in as president in January 2017 to reverse that course. But even that's not guaranteed.
You teach a lot about international affairs, diplomacy. Did the president make a faux pas today by using this opportunity to basically go to a host country and seemingly criticizing it?
Well, from the point of view of the United States and U.S. imperialism, that's par for the course. From the point of view of diplomatic discourse, of course it's a faux pas. But as you know, there is a kind of diplomatic apartheid in the world. That is to say that the International Court of Justice at The Hague routinely indicts and convicts Africans for all manner of human rights transgressions, but has not said a mumbling word about the violations of international law by Tony Blair of Britain or George W. Bush of the United States or any of the other North Atlantic leaders. And so, no, I mean, from the point of view of Washington, this was not a faux pas. This was par for the course. As a matter of fact, President Obama would have been upbraided and denounced in the mainstream press unless he had taken that course. Although I found it very striking that in his speech this morning, he repeated something that's been going on for hundreds of years. That is to say, this idea that the population of African descent in Cuba, that their issues can be easily compared to the population of African descent in North America. It ignores the colonial history of Spanish Cuba, whereby, for example, for a period commencing in the early 1500s, you had Africans and the army of Spanish Cuba. In fact, as I talk about in my book on 1776, they were menacing English and British colonies and the Carolinas and Virginia beginning in the late 1600s going forward. And there has historically been an idea amongst the African population in Cuba that they are in fact Cuban in a way that black people in the United States have found it difficult to say that they are in fact full-blooded U.S. nationals. This has something to do with the fact that few have bothered to notice, which is that when the settlers in the United States overthrew British rule in 1776, they were doing it in part so they could foist even more slavery on the United States, on this continent, and therefore black people opposed that project. and therefore became outliers in terms of the U.S. national project, whereas in Cuba, you had Antonio Maceo in the post-1865 period, a man of African descent, who was leading the struggle not only against slavery, but against Spanish colonial rule. And this kind of idea that I'm putting forward did not evaporate, did not disappear once the United States established its hegemony in the island in the wake of the Spanish-Cuban-U.S. War of 1898, which led to U.S. control over the island. And, of course, this repeated idea that then was brought to the island, that once again Afro-Cubans should see their plight as being the same as so-called African-Americans. Now, that's not to say that there are not problems of racism and discrimination in Cuba. There are such problems, and it's clear that that's one of the loose threads in the Cuban suit that President Obama and those that follow him will be yanking upon vigorously in coming days, weeks, months, and years. But unless there's an accurate analysis of the different historical trajectories of the island in the mainland, I think that their idea, their project will blow up in their faces.
In many ways, one can interpret Cuba's attitude to this rapprochement with the United States as one of a political and economic pragmatism. How do you see it?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, you need to realize that even before December 17th, 2014, when President Obama announced his overture along with President Castro in Havana, there had been rather robust commercial and diplomatic relations between Canada and the United States, and the same holds true, as noted, for China and between Canada and Cuba, and also between China and Cuba, and also between many Western European countries and Cuba. So the United States is arriving a bit late to the party. And I think that from Havana's point of view, if there is going to be competing bids, for example, from U.S. entities and Canadian or Western European entities, the Cubans might be predisposed to favor the latter over the former, because they realize that the U.S. overtures and the U.S. investment packages in many ways are seen as booby traps. There are ways, once again, to get a wedge on the island, which will provide leverage for the ultimate overthrow of the Cuban Communist Party and the Socialist Project. Therefore, it seems to me, once again, that Cuba in many ways is in the catbird seat with regard to this new opening with Washington.
Well, I also noted that in the president's speech today, we'll be talking about it tomorrow, his astute use of race, including as it pertained to himself, to drive home the point about all the things that the United States and Cuba had in common, it was mostly black folks. I was just wondering, how did the president's use of race strike you today?
Well, first of all, the Neanderthal lobby does not appreciate that kind of language. The Neanderthal lobby does not appreciate the fact that President Obama mentioned that both the island and the mainland were built to its present level through the use of slave labor. In the United States discourse, as you know, it's very popular to speak of the United States as a nation of immigrants. Forget the slaves, for example. So that won't go down very well in many quarters in the United States. And this is part of the dilemma that President Obama faces. That is to say that from the point of view and the long-term goals of U.S. imperialism, it's rather wise and smart to play the race card. But from the point of view of the hegemonic Neanderthal lobby in the Republican Party, by speaking of slavery and racism, this conflicts with their idea of the United States as a shining city on the hill. And the kind of propaganda that has been so effective over the decades in convincing so many that the United States is the indispensable nation, the United States is the so-called flawless nation, etc. And it's that kind of contradiction that it seems to me that is ultimately going to cause a crack-up in the U.S. imperial project, at least hopefully.
How does President Obama's presence in Cuba transfer to the chances of a Democrat in the White House? How is that going to be exploited?
You mean a Democratic successor to President Obama?
Yes.
Well, let's say if it's President Hillary Rodham Clinton, she's obviously proven herself to be more hawkish than President Obama. Press coverage, not least in the New York Times a few weeks ago, tends to show that she was the driving force between in the disastrous overthrow of the Libyan regime in 2011, which President Obama, in his now notorious interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic just a few days ago, said was a, quote, mistake, unquote, which, of course, is a gross understatement. It's been a catastrophe, a fiasco, and a debacle. If President Hillary Rodham Clinton is sworn in January 2017, I'm not so sure if you can expect a continuation of the Obama entente with Havana unless it is perceived that the business lobby would be opposed to a reversal of course because of the profits they would be raking in from Havana. I'm speaking of Carnival Cruise Lines, for example, Airbnb, the internet giants who are licking their lips at the prospect of descending upon the island, et cetera. With regard to a possible President Bernie Sanders being sworn in 2017, one can hope that he would continue, if not escalate, the course laid out by President Obama. Recall in the last Democratic debate in Miami, potential President Hillary Rodham Clinton, in a sense, red-baited Bernie Sanders, pointing to some favorable remarks he had made about the Castro regime some decades ago. On the other hand, although his supporters, the most fervent supporters of Senator Sanders, may not be aware, his record with regard to foreign policy has not been as leftist as his domestic policy with regard to, say, breaking up the banks. For example, not being a fervent opponent of the Libyan misadventure of 2011, his Cold War-tinged rhetoric with regard to addressing Russia, his policy towards the Balkans in the 1990s, which virtually destroyed socialist Yugoslavia. So I think that it's not clear what would occur post-Obama, even if a Democrat sits in the White House.
But be sure, I think, that the Republicans, one of the first things they would want to do is reverse any executive order, any initiative Obama has taken with regard to Cuba.
Yes, I think that's a fair assumption. The fly in the ointment from their point of view, once again, would be business. That is to say, Carnival Cruise Line, Airbnb, Starwood's hotel properties, etc. Whether there would be so much momentum on their part in terms of digging their claws into the island that it would be ill-advised for a Republican president to try to reverse all of the momentum created by Obama with his overture. Although, of course, it would be a mistake to take a kind of economist point of view or the point of view of a vulgar economist and always assume that financial and economic interests will reign supreme. History does not bear that out, and certainly ideology, right-wing Neanderthal ideology, always has to be considered when you're talking about the Republican Party of the United States of America.
And finally, as a historian, which is your bailiwick, was this a historic moment?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, look at the Haitian Revolution, for example. The United States, from the triumph of the Haitian Revolution in 1804, did not recognize the Haitian regime until 1862. That's 58 years. From 1959, the triumph of the Cuban Revolution, to December 17, 2014, is 55 years, roughly. So one can say that there has been a progress, in a sense, that the United States has learned, shall we say, to coexist with revolutionary regimes. I should also add parenthetically that what propelled Abraham Lincoln to recognize Haiti, of course, was that Haiti was one of the few allies in the hemisphere that the United States had in confronting rebellious, slaveholding, so-called Confederate States of America. But once again, it's not clear to me that this historic overture by President Obama will have staying power. A lot of it will depend not only on who was sworn into office in January 2017, but also on the strength of the people's movements going forward. And that, too, is a question mark.
I want to thank you, as usual, a very, very thoughtful and incisive interview with you today, Gerald. We always learn so much when you are on the program. You share your insights with us, and we benefit from all the things you are. You are an attorney, you're a professor of history and diplomacy, and a prolific author. Thank you so much. What's next for you? What's your next book? I know you just put out the one on Robeson, and we should be talking about that soon. But what are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a number of projects, but the one that's about to pop out of the oven, hopefully within the next year or so, is a book on pro-Tokyo sentiment amongst black Americans in the run-up to World War II.
Wow. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Bye. Well, a lot to learn. We'll be talking, by the way, tomorrow. We'll be dissecting the president's speech. I just heard some groans, but, you know, this is what we do. You know that. It's a historic moment. We ought to appreciate what was said in this historic moment by the Commander-in-Chief of the United States. So we'll be parsing his speech and looking at the clues for what we should expect from his visit and the significance of his visit. And we'll get into that discussion tomorrow. But what I want to do right now is turn your attention to something that I think you should value above all else, and that is your health. As you know, I've shared with you my own story. I have had reason to take pause because my diagnosis was given to me one day, April the 12th last year, and it was daunting, to say the least. It was very shocking. Cancer, stage 4, out of nowhere. And so I had to stop and regather myself and put myself on track and place myself on track as priority number one, something I had never done in all of my years. I never put myself first. It was always work. I mean, I worked like a demon. I worked in one stretch 19 years without a single sick day or vacation day. And I worked at a job when I left, practically 11 people full-time had to be hired to do what I used to do by myself. I mean, this is worked with a great ferociousness. But my health was really the issue. And it came to be, our office was right down the street from the World Trade Center. I don't know if that's where it originated, but I have reason to believe it might be. But in any event, it's irrelevant. The fact is, this is an issue I have to deal with. And suddenly, I have to get real clear about what is important. And what is important is me hanging in and staying on for as long as I can in good health. Now, that may sound odd, but believe it or not, when I go in for my tests, my periodic tests, doctors look at me and say, wow, you look really good. And I feel good. And I feel good largely because I have put myself in the hands of Gary Null, in the hands of the guest we're about to meet, Luann Panessi, and they have been advising me in ways, on ways which I can build my body's defense mechanisms so that I can extend my life and live as fully as possible. And that is really what I aim to do. And I think I'm on good ground here. I'm gaining a great deal of benefit from following these protocols. I will let you know that on the day I got my diagnosis, and I, of course, was hospitalized because it was an emergency situation, the minute I knew that I was going to be released, I knew exactly where I was going to go. And I was going to go directly to Gary's protocols. And he put together something that I have been following. Of course, there's no promise, and I want to be really clear about this. This is not about a cure. I'm very, very, very much aware there is no cure. But what there is the ability to help your body help itself. And imagine if it is doing such a good job with me in my circumstance, I can only suggest to you that it would do a great job for you just in maintaining maximum health. We don't know. I don't know. And frankly, I'm not interested at this point in hunting down the cause. I'm interested in living in the now, and living in the now in such a way that I could have a pretty enjoyable future. I'm really, really clear about it. And so I am discussing today how you can make available to yourselves and to people you love the opportunity to put yourselves first, your health first, and to ensure that you could be around as long as possible and as vital as possible. And that is my lead-in to Luann Panessi, who has been in the field of alternative health for many years, more than three decades, and who is going to share with us how you can take advantage of the great opportunity to put yourself first. Hey, Luann.
Hi, Yatrice. Wow, you just hit the nail on the head.
Tell me why I knit the... What about what I said hit the nail on the head?
I think that so many of us, especially women, have been entrained to work, and we become so preoccupied with doing everything for everyone else, and we come last. And that is the spiritual breakdown that is part of what cancer is about. It's not just cancer, though. It's most every autoimmune illness, infectious illness. And, again, we've been entrained to be workaholics. I was a workaholic. A lot of people work so hard because they have to be a good mother, wife, sibling, you know, school member. There's so many different things that we're doing, and when do we have time for ourselves? Well, I've been changing my life, and my life is constantly evolving to higher and higher levels based on Gary's work. Now, you know, Gary does a lot of controversial things, and our conditioned minds, often we want to dig our heels in and say, oh, you know, that's just Gary being angry. And so Gary is passionate about helping people to be their very best. And every now and again when his schedule opens up, he has these retreats. They're kind of a time for you to get back to you and start a whole new chapter in your life. And one of the other things that you had mentioned, you know, I think that our beliefs that we're fine, even though we know we might have a little, you know, imbalance here, a little imbalance there, we want to believe that we're fine. And denial is one of the greatest defense mechanisms that we have until you get that diagnosis that, you know, you have stage 4 cancer, get your affairs in order and get into hospice. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, is that a wake-up call. And this retreat is not for just people with cancer. It's for anybody. We're working with athletes. We've got people who just need to get a break, and they need to get back to themselves. And how do we do it? We put you in a pristine environment. where you're going to, some people for the first time, just sitting back and enjoying nature, formal gardens, a beautiful lake, and oh, I just found out that we have a swan family and she's sitting on 3 eggs. So we might just have baby swans by the time everyone's going to get there. We are going to do exercise. We help people to move their bodies. Now, when you leave this retreat, you're going to leave with information and tools for ways to integrate exercise and movement into your everyday life. And a lot of people that are the workaholics are going to say, well, wait a minute, I don't have time to exercise. Well, yeah, you do. If you're driving into work or you're sitting on a subway, you can just squeeze your butt cheeks together, and you can just do that. You might end up getting an extra seat next to you. But there's lots of ways to do isometric exercises where you least expect it. So we help you to figure out ways to, and plus you end up with a great butt. That's all I'm saying. So, well, you know, there's lots of ways for people to exercise. For, and that's just one example. So we have personal trainers there. We're going to have someone teaching a very integrative Zumba class, which is going to be fun. And we're going to do it right in the yoga hut on the lake. It's going to be a blast. We have yoga classes that we have right on the lake. We're going to have, we have a pool with a cabana, and our personal trainer is constantly teaching people how to, no matter what state you're in, I don't care if you're overweight, underweight, have muscles, don't have muscles, John Q is there to help you maximize your workout, whatever that is for you. And then, of course, we have meditation classes, emotional release classes. That's one of the most fun classes. People love it because they have the opportunity to release pent-up emotions they didn't even realize were in there. And it's the broken spirit you treat. It's the suppression of these negative emotions that we don't get to process that are often the root of our chronic illnesses. This has been very well documented in the literature. So we give you an opportunity to finally let go of whatever anger, frustration, resentment, fear, jealousy. We help you to release all that so that you can now get back to who you are and not be affected by the power of other people's dysfunction. And, of course, on top of that, we have gourmet cuisine. Oh, my God. It's just outrageous, mouth-watering food all day long. We have a huge banquet in the afternoon. We have organic juices going all day long with protein smoothies. Anything you need, we're going to have, oh, I interviewed the chefs with Gary, and, you know, Gary has very high standards for his chefs and for people that are going to make his recipes. And we happen to have two phenomenal chefs that are coming down to help to make all the food for everybody. So it's going to be a blast. We're also having an herbologist come down who's going to talk about the power of herbs. You know, one of the greatest things I learned from Gary's retreat is that there is a plant to rebalance every imbalance in the human body. I had no idea. And the whole field of herbs, American herbs, Chinese herbs, it's all about rebalancing the body. So we're going to have an herbologist coming down. I'm doing individualized health counseling on anybody who is interested. You make an appointment with me, you meet with me, we spend a half hour together, and I can give you information on anything you want. We will be having cooking classes. We're going to teach you about sprouting. Anyone can do sprouting. You've got a window, you can do sprouting. We also have art classes. So for people that want to express themselves through some form of art, it's just fabulous.
Now, so, this takes place at the end of April, so people have to move now. Tell us the dates.
April 17th to the 23rd, and again the 24th to the 30th, and we have special pricing if people want to stay for 2 weeks. We fill up very quickly, and I only have one or two spots for the first week, and I have five or six openings for the following week. And it's going to be fun. Gary is there. He lectures every evening. And, hey, the most important thing here for people in your audience to know is that you, Treece, will be there in the flesh.
I will be. I plan
she's
on being
be,
there.
I
just want to mention, when you said how dire the situation was, it really was. I was told last year, go home, and make yourself as comfortable as possible. Death was imminent, and they weren't kidding. You know, that was what I was told. Just go home and make yourself comfortable. And that there was nothing else that could be done. And here I am, almost a year later, and looking good, feeling well, walking, and I've become athletic in my old age. I'm clocking in 8 and 10 miles a day.
So, you go, girl.
And taking the supplements and taking the exercise of John Q and putting it to good use. So I urge you to do this. But I'm not alone. Let's share with the audience, Luann, the benefits that this person got out of the retreat.
My name is Oleno, Joseph Oleno. And my coming here for this retreat has been a great eye-opener and a great game-changer for me. I've learned a lot of many things here, things that will benefit me and let me live a good, healthy life. I've learned that good nutrition, changing lifestyle, exercise, support system, and more especially with information and tuning into the energies around has been of great benefit. And as a matter of fact, I would like to repeat this retreat every now and then because it is very, very beneficial and very helpful. And I intend to follow all the directions and instructions and the advice that has been provided to us here. And this is a great experience that I will recommend to everyone. It is a great life changer. Very great. And I appreciate that. Thanks, Gary.
Hi.
Let's hear this other person's testimonial.
Vulnerable, horrific pain, and very, very, very confused. And it's the first time in many years that I've felt in such disarray. I did not know what to expect from this retreat. But what I got from it was transforming. It was life-altering. I know I will live the rest of my life truly, authentically. I lost myself, and I found myself again with Gary's amazing guidance and his pure intention. I say integrity is doing the right thing when nobody's looking, and this has truly, truly changed the course of my life. I know I'll bring it into my practice with me, with my clients who I adore. So professionally, personally, and on every level, spiritually, I cannot thank Gary Null enough for making such a difference and such a change. For the better, definitely. But for eternally. And I send all my love out to him and to the universe that I know I am part of now.
What an incredible testimonial. Two incredible testimonials. Luann, tell us a bit about the mechanics of the retreat. Where is it? You already told us it's from the 17th to the 23rd. That's 1 week. Another week begins on the 24th to the 30th. And tell us what people have to do to get into this retreat.
Well, basically, it takes place in northeast Texas. It's just south of Arkansas by Texarkana. It's in a beautiful area. It looks like upstate New York. It's hilly. It's got these gigantic 200-foot pine trees and this formal gardens. It's an Italian villa, and exquisite. It was built in the early, the late 1920s, like 1928, by Italian artisans. So the building itself is a piece of history. It's just beautiful. But what you're going to need to do is give me a call. I'm going to give you my number. It's 631-504-6198. Again, call 631-504-6198. And I interview everyone to make sure this is the right venue for you. You know, this isn't a medical type of a practice or anything like that. This is specifically to help people to reclaim their life, to reclaim their health. You get the foundations of healthy habits. You learn self-responsibility. And for some people, it's just a matter of learning to set boundaries in their life so that they can take good care of themselves so they can be more for each other. So give me a call. Good. Did you have something?
No, go ahead. The number?
Yeah, give me a call. The number again is 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And let us help you to be your very best emotionally, physiologically, environmentally, your relationships. It's all that. It's all that. It's not a vacation.
I want to give my own little testimonial, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I want to share with people, really, to call this a wake-up call that I got is to engage in serious understatement. I mean, it was a slam, a huge body slam. And yet, the comfort for me was that I knew there would be someplace I can go and someone I can turn to for help. The genuine help. Now, mind you, this is occurring at 100 miles an hour. All of this is happening to me in one fell swoop. And yet, I did not feel devastated. I did not feel that it was all over. I felt that I needed to call somebody, and I knew who that person was. I've known Gary for 30 years, and he was the person I called. And the minute I talked with him, he said, okay, just come on, and we'll start the work right away. As soon as I got there, I met, in fact, three other people waiting for me to get me under control, to get to work. And I strongly believe, I have no other proof to offer you but my word, my own experience, I strongly believe if I had not had that available to me, I would have been gone in no time. But it is a year coming up on April 12th. I would be celebrating, God willing, and the creek don't rise, a full year. And not only just that, no one in my family, they look at me and go, you don't look like you have. Can't you terminally ill? My doctor says it. And I am outpacing everybody. I'm up by 7 o'clock in the morning. I have already done my time out there walking. I've already put in my miles.
Wow.
I am moving. I am getting things done. I am not hobbled. And I'm vital. I feel good. And that, to me, that's the biggest victory for me at this point, to be able to live fully in the moment. And I could only tell you that this is, in my view, the best defense ever that you will have against anything, including a terminal illness. Just to have yourself refocused. Imagine if it's working for me at this stage that I have been deemed to be in terms of my health, and I feel so good. Imagine what it would do for you to just bring you into proper maintenance of your health. And for someone that you love, if you are not able to make it, I urge you to give it as a gift to somebody important to you. Luann, one more time, let us hear how people can get to participate in this retreat. I intend to be there.
Very good. We're looking forward to it. I'm at 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. You'll get my answering machine most likely, but just leave your name and your phone number and say, I'm interested in the retreat. I will call you back within 24 hours. And we'll see if we can get you signed up. And I think the word is balance. We help people to create balance in their life. Because where there's balance and where there's love, there's always help. So when you're coming, when you're living in fear, and hasn't our government just entrained us to live in fear day and night? And if you're living out of balance in terms of balancing your time, exercising, relaxing, loving, spending time with your loved ones, your pets, your family, when that balance is off, then there's anxiousness, and then there's fear, and then, you know, they give you medications for this, and they have side effects. So we help you to get to a place of more balance in your life by understanding the impact that exercise and relaxation and meditation, maybe yoga, and maybe just reflecting and sitting in nature every day. I do. Every day I sit outside in nature, even if it's snowing out. There's something beautiful about that, too. So thankfully we've seen, hopefully we've seen the last of the snow until the winter. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting many Lead Stories listeners. We could have our own little Lead Stories program right there in the retreat. It would be great to meet you. Thanks, Luann, for being with us today and sharing this information with us.
It's a joy, and I hope you're going to be doing some lectures with people and doing some kind of kitchen table sit-downs with us.
Certainly. Just like the last retreat, I was there. It was great. I was so pleased to have been there and to meet up with Lead Stories folk. Thanks again.
Great. Okay.
Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I really want to emphasize how important it is to take care of your health. It is the only thing you really, really have. So you want to safeguard it. But also, if you can't make it in that time frame, consider strongly making this a gift to somebody you really care about. Because I'm telling you, and it may sound like a cliche, but your health is the very, very most important thing that you have. And it is something that you can do something about. If you're not in a good state of health, you can bring yourself into a good state of health and not wait until catastrophe befalls you. And then you go, oh my gosh, now I have to get better. But your body all the while has been begging for attention, and we very often ignore it. So I urge you to participate, and you should want to do so. Give this as a gift to someone you love. Thanks so much for joining me today. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. You can write me a little note at leadstories@gmail.com. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.